may have, as we saw later when we were at Tokyo for the surrender, that these B-29s used many firebombs to destroy much of Japan's towns and cities, which were built of combustible material, wood.
Mm-hmm. Well, Robert, let me ask you about how you came to actually be in Tokyo. How did that come about?
Well, after the Japanese asked for terms of surrender on August 15th of 1945, we continued on our patrol station until August 28th. And then we were told to rendezvous with four other submarines and head for Tokyo Bay. And one submarine did not rendezvous with us because he had encountered a large Japanese submarine, I-400, that was just dead in the water. I mean, not going anywhere. And
mm-hmm.
And they contacted the commanding officer and asked if they could send someone to the Jap submarine. And he said, don't send any officers, but you could send enlisted men. So the executive officer put on enlisted men's clothing, and maybe another officer did likewise. But they did go over to this Japanese submarine, and the commanding officer of the Japanese submarine was very troubled about what to do. He had on board the squadron commander of the submarines who had committed harakiri, that is, had taken his own life when he heard of the surrender.
Yes, sir.
And so that submarine didn't proceed with the rest of us, but the four of us, including Haddo, went underway that day about noon, I guess, and we went down the coast or wherever the others came from, and then we entered the harbor at the south end. Tokyo Harbor is shaped somewhat like a light bulb or a pear with a small entrance to the south.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were, the next day after we had received those orders to come to Tokyo Bay, we were approaching the harbor, and on small islands around we saw white, maybe bed sheets, I don't know, signifying that Japanese coastal batteries were surrendering or would not interfere. And we arrived in Tokyo Harbor just off Yokosuka Naval Base, which was very large, equivalent to Norfolk, Virginia in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And ships of ever imaginable type, American, British, Australian, one free French, I remember, but a total of at least 250 vessels. I remember three of our big battleships, Missouri, on which the surrender was signed, Iowa, and South Dakota were there. None of the big carriers came in. They stayed out at sea so they could launch planes in case any kind of treachery on the part of the Japanese was involved. And anyhow...
Mm-hmm.
We were there 2 days, I guess.
Do you know what date you arrived?
Let's see. I guess the 30th. We arrived on the 30th, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
In the 29th or 30th of August. And then we found that the United States submarine tender Proteus had come in, and also... eight other submarines, so there was a total of 12 submarines, and tied up alongside the submarine tender Proteus, there were six on the starboard side and six on the port side, and we were the outboard submarine on the port side, the outside one, and Proteus was swinging at anchor, and of course we swung around with them. But also, the submarine rescue vessel Greenlet, Greenlet,
mm-hmm.
It was also there, but was not connected to this tender and her nest of submarines.
Mm-hmm.
And something of interest, as we look toward the big Japanese naval base. Adjoining the naval base for surface ships, the big part of it was a Japanese submarine base with a few Japanese submarines. At anchor, lying between where Proteus and her submarines were, and the submarine base on shore, was this big Japanese submarine, I-401. On September the 1st, our communications officer managed to catch a ride on a boat over to the big Japanese submarine and to go through it.
Mm-hmm.
And he found that a petty officer who could speak a little bit of English, as many Japanese could, and underfoot in the living quarters were wooden planks, and he wondered what was going on,
uh-huh.
And he learned that underneath these planks were jars of ashes of Japanese who had been cremated at the island stronghold of Truk.
Uh-huh.
What happened, our forces did not invade Truk, but they bombed it, and the surface ships, battleships and such, shelled it,
yes.
To where they pretty much destroyed it. But anyhow,
yes.
It was bypassed. But then patrol ships were set around it to where there could be no traffic to and from. The Japanese on Truk Island were starving to death, so this big submarine had taken a load of rice in bags out to Truk, unloaded the rice, and also had some rats on board.
Uh-huh.
And then they took on board, I don't know how many, but 100 or more of these small urns, ceramic urns, with the ashes of Japanese people who had been cremated there,
uh-huh.
after being sick, wounded, or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Anyhow, they died. And these ashes were then brought back to the home island, but had not been unloaded and were still on board when my fellow officer, Carl Hartigan, our communications officer, went on board and visited.
That's very interesting.
And then on September the 2nd, the day of surrender,
mm-hmm.
The night before, one of the officers, Jack Keller, he was an Annapolis graduate. He asked me what I thought about trying to get on shore and see some of Japan. And I was agreeable and enthusiastic. So then at the evening meal on September 1st in the submarine,
mm-hmm.
we contacted the other officers. And it ended up with a total of 7 out of 10 were willing to make this trip.
Okay.
And so the next morning, I was topside a little after 8 a.m., and I looked over toward the big submarine tender, and I saw a party come down off that and start crossing from submarine to submarine on the gangways. And when they got to Haddo, my boat,
mm-hmm.
I saw that the party included Admiral Charles Lockwood, Vice Admiral Charles Lockwood, who was commander of all submarine activities in the Pacific, and with him were at least three members of his staff. And they went down into a launch, captain's launch, and they went over to the Missouri battleship to participate or observe the surrender ceremonies of the Japanese.
And you obviously stayed on the Haddo at that time as they took off in the launch.
Yes, it was 9 o'clock, nearly an hour later, when the rest of HATO officers who were agreeable to going ashore came up topside, and we boarded a small, it's a landing craft, LCVP, and we rode over to and landed at the Japanese submarine base. And we looked around there and found out that it was separated from the big naval base by a wall, a masonry wall, concrete blocks or such, at least 8 feet tall. There was a gate between the two bases, but U.S. Marines on the gate would not allow us to go through.
Oh, is that right?
So we went back and we found a spot where there was an old wooden ladder lying on the ground against the building, and the Marine guarding, watching his marching his post, he had would pass around a corner behind the building where he could not see us. So we took the ladder and put it up against that wall, and all of them went over except, well, four jumped off on the ground on the other side, and two stayed astride on top of the wall, and I put the ladder back, and then I jumped up, and they grabbed my hands and pulled me up, and the three of us jumped down, and that put all seven of us over on the big naval base, which had tremendous destruction from U.S. Bombs, and we walked through it, didn't see anything much except a lot of destruction. We did see a naval airstrip where they could land planes, and also a hangar for planes cut back into the side of one of those little mountains that were prolific, very many of them. And anyhow, we walked through that base and had no problem walking right out on the street in Yokosuka, Japan. I don't know what size town it was, but it was very much connected to and dependent upon that big Navy base. And it was from there, after we walked, I don't know how far, a mile or two, we heard trains running, and we came to a railroad station, which was very crude, but we are just, without having to pay any fare or anything, we just got on board a train and rode north through countryside, then Yokohama, and then into downtown Tokyo.
And were there Japanese civilians around?
Oh, it was crowded. It was packed. We stood in the aisles and held on to the straps like you would on the subways in New York.
Sure.
And they were every seat was packed, and there were Japanese standing, crowded in all around us. I was the hindmost man of the seven standing in the aisle, and there were Japanese packed in on three sides of me. And when we went through a tunnel, and it became rather dark except for one light bulb in the coach. I reached down. We were each of the seven wearing sidearms, Colt 45 caliber pistols. I reached down and pulled the bottom of my jacket tied around my hips, so no one could reach in and get my gun without me realizing what was going on. But they didn't offer any antagonism of any kind toward us.
Obviously, they were looking at you.
Oh, yes.
But you didn't sense any...
Well, on some that were evidently discharged servicemen, soldiers going home, there were some hostile looks, but of the common people, they appeared to be poor and with simple clothing and just desperate to get to home or to get somewhere. I don't know where they were going. As we passed through Yokohama, a city equivalent to Detroit, we saw tremendous damage from bombing, firebombs. Everything burned, buildings blasted down, and rusting machinery used in war effort, construction of war machines and so forth. And the people seemed very somewhat sad or discouraged or just not interested in anything that would continue what the people had been going through, which was a lot of hardship.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So the destruction was just, would you say, virtually total?
Yes, in Yokohama. When I got into Tokyo, it was a mixed bag. We got off at the downtown main railway station, and the roof was gone off of that building. But we looked across and saw a fairly large building to our left, and we went over there, and it appeared to be the post office. This was on a Sunday, September the 2nd. And we went in. There were young ladies at the windows, but when they saw us, they screamed and ran away from their window. But a man came up then, and one of our people asked him if he could speak any English, and he said very poorly. And so he directed us to go to another building nearby across the way. And when we did, we found out it was the Tokyo headquarters of the Japan National Railway. And we sat it down in there, and they brought us a man, appeared to be maybe 60 or 65. I couldn't judge the age of a Japanese. But he was a railway guide or employee, and he said he would be able to help us and ask what we wanted to do, and we said we wanted to see some of downtown Tokyo, and he agreed to be our guide. And so he then took us around. And it was while we were en route up to Tokyo that the Japanese were signing the surrender on board USS Missouri battleship down in the southern end of Tokyo Harbor, just off Yokosuka.
Yes, sir.
On board this Missouri. And so while we had gotten off the train, we noticed, though, that flights of aircraft, U.S. aircraft, were flying overhead. I don't know why they wanted to put on a demonstration of U.S. or Allied power, but they did. And several scores of our planes flew overhead.
Now, when you say you don't really know why they wanted to do that,
No, I don't.
Was it sort of overkill in a way?
There were no attacks made. Nothing would justify that the surrender was not genuine. And I assume it was just a show off of U.S. or Allied power that they flew those planes overhead.
When you were going about with this gentleman from the Japanese railway, did he walk you around, or did you have some kind of conveyance?
No transportation. He walked us around. And we, one of the first places we went, a walk of maybe three-quarters of a mile, was to the Imperial Palace, where the emperor lived, and we were not allowed to go in on the palace grounds, but we went up to the moat surrounding the palace. There was an iron bridge over the moat. The building was snow white. I don't know how high it was, maybe 40 feet, with pagoda roof style. And we noticed when we approached the bridge across the moat into the palace that there were Japanese soldiers guarding this bridge, and they did have sidearms. And as we approached, they unsnapped the flap over their pistols and placed the flap in behind the gun so they could draw the gun quickly if they decided to do so. But then when we saw that, we turned away so as not to create a situation.
Mm-hmm.
And
was that kind of a scary moment?
No, just a careful moment.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And from there, we went through some kind of a garden area. It had many of these trees that had been very much manicured.
Mm-hmm.
Trees that were very old but were still small because they had been pruned and shaped and so forth.
Yes.
And on the way to the palace, we passed the big Japanese bank building that didn't show bomb damage. We did see some bomb damage in downtown Tokyo, but not as much as you might think.
Mm-hmm.
And General MacArthur had made sure that there were no bombs dropped on the Imperial Palace. He realized the fact that the emperor was somewhat of a god to the Japanese, and he decided that it would be wise not to harm him in any way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was the gentleman that you were touring with trying to talk a little bit as you went along?
Answered questions, mainly.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Shirato. I would guess it was spelled S-H-I-R-A-T-O.
Okay.
And he expressed one of our group. Jack Keller gave him cigarettes, which pleased him.
Uh-huh.
He said that he was interested in baseball, that he said, "I know Lou Gehrig," which meant he knew who he was.
Uh-huh.
And he said, "I saw Babe Ruth, the uh-huh. famous American baseball player back in the 30s. And he may have... Babe Ruth may have made a tour to Japan,
mm-hmm.
exhibition tour of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, he said he had seen him, so he was much interested in baseball. And finally, it was noontime, and we mentioned something about food, and so he took us to this big Imperial Hotel, which was designed as an earthquake-proof building by Frank Lloyd Wright, the American architect.
Mm-hmm.
And it was built back in the 30s, and it was a pyramid style of architecture. And when we got there and went in, we found people, waiters, whatever, could speak some English.
Mm-hmm.
We also found a U.S. Army staff sergeant named Johnson, who said he had driven up from Yokosuka the day before in a jeep, and he said he had a terrible time getting through Yokohama and into Japan, into Tokyo, Japan, but he had finally made it, and he was very, excuse me, he was very proud of himself. He said he had been present with the U.S. airborne troops that were first into Berlin when the European War ended, and anyhow, he had nothing but photographic equipment. He had no arms,
mm-hmm.
and we found there at the Imperial Hotel some Red Cross people and news people, but we also found that we were the first armed or combatant people of the Allied forces to be in Tokyo at the end of the war.
Did you have a chance to speak with the Red Cross people?
Not very much. We spoke very little to them.
Mm-hmm. And did you get something to eat?
Yes, we did. I don't know if I can remember. I have it written down what we had. One was some kind of soup. I think. I don't know if it was barley soup or what. It was thin soup, and we had some rice and a small piece of octopus tentacle with suction cups on it. And we had tea, and we couldn't manage to eat some of that stuff. It was just too different from what we were accustomed to. And
sure.
Of course, the people of Japan and Tokyo were in starvation circumstances, so the food that we didn't touch was taken away, and I'm sure that someone else ate it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, all we had to do to pay for it was just the senior officer in our group was the executive officer, Jim Calvert, and he just wrote on little slips of paper, U.S. Navy, and they call them CHITS, C-H-I-T-S, CHITS in the Navy. And so he signed for them, and we walked out and started down through the main section of Tokyo, what is called the Ginza, somewhat similar to Broadway in New York, USA.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we attracted more attention than we had before. Children began to follow us. Soldiers, with not carrying any arms, but still wearing their uniforms, would look at us with looks of animosity and hatred, and they would hiss at our guide to show their contempt for him. And we went by one or two movie theaters, and he asked us if we wanted to go in, but we certainly didn't want to get in there in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, we came back. We had told him that we wanted to leave not later than 4 p.m. to go back to our base and our sub. So we got back to the railway office about 2:30, and we were sitting there, and these young Japanese boys came in. It didn't look to be more than 9 years old. They were served us cups of tea. It was pale in color, very hot, and in beautiful little cups. China
mm-hmm.
cups that had the Mount Fujiyama picture, not a picture, but you know,
an image of that.
Yes. And then after a short wait, our guide said it's time to go to the depot, railway station, and get on the train to go back down to where we had come from originally. And we had ridden on the lowest class coaches coming up north into Tokyo, and that's where we saw so many pathetic-looking people,
mm-hmm.
and everything was very crude and all. But the coach that we were put on to come back was the first class, and it was very nice.
How were they different, Robert?
All the seats and everything, the upholstery, the seating,
mm-hmm.
everything about it was much nicer. And on the way down to Yokohama, two young Japanese naval officers got on the same coach we were on and came and stood by the seat where I was sitting with my friends. And that's where I saw real hatred in the eyes of another person, as those young men, I assume they were about the same rank I was, an ensign, and as they stood there in the aisle and looked at us and looked at me, they certainly had a hostile look in their eyes.
What would you say the message was that they were probably getting from your group? Were you guys calm? Were you?
Yes, we were calm,
uh-huh.
and we each had on a jacket that had a cartoon insignia on the back that was our ship, our submarine, that is.
Yes.
It was an insignia that showed a submarine and a man leaning out of it with a umbrella and a firecracker or something. But anyhow, those children that followed us down the Ginza thought it was very funny, this insignia on the back of our boat jackets, our boat insignia.
Sure.
And we got back down to Yokosuma and got off the train and headed back over to the base, the Navy base, and we encountered a jeep with a Marine Lieutenant Colonel and his driver, and he was hostile. He wanted to know what we were doing out there, and we said, just looking around. We certainly didn't tell him we'd been to Tokyo, and he said, how did you get out? He wondered how we'd gotten past his guards.
Sure.
And we said, we just walked out. Well, he said, walk back in now. So we got back over to the base, and we had a little trouble getting back in from the Marine guard on the gate, but we finally made it. And when we got into the submarine's base of the Japanese there, we found out that they were having a victory party at the Japanese Officers Club with the Admiral Kamsa Pak and several ranking officers and submarine captains and so forth. And two of our party dropped off at that victory party, and the others of us caught a boat and went back to our submarine and found out that we were having turkey dinner with all the trimmings that night, which was very nice.
Now, that must have already all been on the ship.
And that's after we got back on the submarine.
Mm-hmm. Robert, how long did you stay there in Tokyo Harbor?
We left the very next morning on September the 3rd. We had refueled, and the captain announced early in the morning, I guess it was at breakfast time. Now, ordinarily, a submarine on patrol makes a trim dive every morning to make sure that the submarine is in neutral trim. In other words, it doesn't try to sink or it doesn't try to surface. It's in perfect trim. And so the captain announced, he said, there's an element of risk in every dive, and these men have been through enough risk, so we're not going to make another dive till we get back to the United States. Each day we'll turn on the low-pressure blowers to get the ballast tanks as near empty as we can to provide the shallowest draft and the maximum speed.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's exactly what we did, and we set sail for Pearl Harbor, and that's where we ended up in how many days? I can't remember, five or something like that.
What was the mood on the ship as you were steaming away from conquered Japan?
Well, I think I'd better go back to when we got the message that the Japanese had asked for surrender terms.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
That message came in a little after midnight, and I was on watch in the radio shack as a decoding officer. And there was also always an enlisted radio man. But the Navy regulations required that if a message came through that was coded either secret or top secret, that only a commissioned officer, not an enlisted man, was allowed to read it. But so that meant there had to be a commissioned officer in the radio shack with the enlisted radio woman whenever these messages were decoded. We had the best decoding system, coding and decoding system in the world.
Yes, sir.
And so I was not able to type. I hadn't taken typing in school. So the radioman that I stood watches with was named Emil Hordesky. He was from Pennsylvania. In pity, and for me, when the message came through coded secret, he would put up a piece of cardboard to where he could not read that tape as it came out of the machine.
Mm.
but he'd pass it on to me.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow,
wow.
But to continue with my story, when that word came through that the Japanese had asked for surrender terms, I went and gave it to the message to the executive officer, Jim Calvert, and he in turn woke the skipper, Frank Lynch. And the skipper got on the sound system, which went into every part of the submarine.
Mm-hmm.
The submarine was a little over 300 feet long. And when he announced that, you would think that there'd be great cheering and celebrating. We had two men in the crew who had lost brothers during the war. But when that word was announced that the war was over, I didn't hear a sound. The men were very serious. We later saw the pictures from Time and Life and Look magazine of the celebrations at New York and San Francisco and
mm-hmm.
wherever, with these soldiers and sailors grabbing all the women and girls and kissing them and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But on the submarine, it was absolutely quiet.
Very somber.
Very somber.
Mm.
And when we departed from Tokyo to go to Pearl Harbor, there was just a quiet spirit of gratitude and thankfulness to have survived the war, that the war was over. And everybody had a good attitude. It was only after the war ended and I got back to the States that we decommissioned the submarine Haddo, and I was transferred to a surface ship that was in February of 1946, that I found servicemen who were very bad attitude. All they wanted was to get out of the service.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to do their duty. They didn't want to do anything right.
Mm-hmm.
But there was none of that on the submarine, which I was proud. The submarine service is a superior service.
Those guys on the surface ships, what were their complaints? Were they legitimate or were they just
no? They didn't want to work. They didn't want to do their duty. They didn't want to do anything but get out and go home.
Mm-hmm. Now, how long did you stay on active service, Robert?
I served on that surface ship. Let's see, 3 months, and then I was released from service around the 1st of June, 1946.
I understand from your daughter that you ended up here in the Lubbock area.
Yes, I stayed at father and mother had a small farm, and I stayed and worked on it and on my mother's or grandmother's, or otherwise my mother's home place, you might say, which was another farm in another county.
Mm-hmm.
For latter part of 46 and part of 47, and then I moved to Lubbock County in late 1947.
What brought you out here, Robert?
Say again.
What made you come out to Lubbock?
Well, I had several relatives in the area.
Okay.
Because my grandfather Ray and his wife and their 11 children had moved to the area, the South Plains area,
mm-hmm.
in 1908 and stayed a few years and then moved back to Tennessee. So I had many relatives that were in the Lubbock area, some that stayed out of the 11 children. And I don't know why, with an engineering degree, but I decided I'd like to work out of doors and
mm-hmm.
alone.
Mm-hmm.
And anyhow, my uncle, husband of one of my father's 9 sisters at Lubbock, he owned 3 farms, and he invited me to come out and operate those farms, 1 in Lubbock County and 2 in Hockley County.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came out in late 1947, And I lived on the same farm then for 55 years. But after having colon cancer surgery in October of 2002, it was necessary that we move down to this area north of east of Fort Worth,
mm-hmm.
where our daughter lived, so she could care for my wife, a victim of multiple sclerosis for 20-plus years. And she could care for my wife while I received 8 months of chemotherapy. I had the colon cancer surgery at Lubbock.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had the 8 months of chemotherapy, bought a house down here a half a mile from where my daughter lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I lost my wife in October of 2003 from multiple sclerosis. In April preceding her death, she began to lose the ability to swallow or to cough. And that finally ended up with somehow she ingested some kind of foreign article. I don't know, medicine or what. It got in her lung, caused an infection,
sure.
which caused her death.
Now, what was your wife's name, and where did you marry her?
My wife's name was Billy Ann, A-N-N-E. And she was a native of El Dorado, Arkansas. And she was a graduate of Texas Women's University. And
right?
She was serving at First Baptist Church Lubbock as director of youth ministry when I met her. And then we were married in 1961.
Here in Lubbock, then?
Yes, in Lubbock.
Mm-hmm. And I know that Marjan, your daughter, told me she had attended Texas Tech.
Yes, both of our children. Our first child was our son,
mm-hmm.
and he graduated from Texas Tech as an honor graduate in agricultural engineering.
Yes, sir.
And then he decided that it was what he needed to do was to go to volunteer for service with the Baptist Student Ministries, and he was sent to University of Saskatchewan in Canada,
mm-hmm.
where he stayed about a year and a half. And he realized while he was up there that he needed more training, so he came back to Texas, and he applied for and was accepted at Southwestern Baptist Seminary at Fort Worth.
Yes, sir.
Where he studied for 3 years and was graduated. Our daughter, 2 years younger, she got an undergraduate and master's degree at Texas Tech, and she became a school teacher, but she then met and married her husband, who was a graduate of Texas Tech in petroleum engineering, but he also was attending Southwestern Baptist Seminary at the same time our son was.
I see, uh-huh.
And so after he graduated from seminary, they stayed in this area, and he did some teaching at the seminary as adjunct professor of ethics. His degree, his doctoral degree, was in ethics.
Mm-hmm.
He got both the Master of Divinity and a doctor's degree in ethics from the seminary. He taught some at the seminary, but he also had a sideline job at remodeling homes, of which he was very very much skilled at that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was first employed by a remodeling contractor, and then he became self-employed. And then the job at the seminary was terminated when they ran short on money,
mm-hmm.
funds.
Mm-hmm. Well, you, I'm sure, are and quite rightfully so, proud of both of those.
Yes, I'm very proud of both of my children.
Robert, do I have your permission to make this this oral history recording available to researchers?
Yes.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for participating in this oral history project and for giving us you know, firsthand account of your own experiences on the submarine and the men that you served with and the service that you gave to the country. Thank you for doing this.
Yes.